Good morning. We'd like to welcome again our great colleague, Senior Judge Walter Cox, who has graciously consented to sit with us for this week's cases. We originally had two cases for this morning. That has been whittled down to one because the other case has been disposed of in another fashion. So the only case we have this morning is United States versus Williams. Is the appellant ready to argue? Is the government ready to argue? Okay, appellant may argue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Carrier, and Captain Cody Donovan-Cheek and I represent Sergeant Gene Williams. In this case, the Army Corps purported to find an exception to this court's decision in United States versus Hills. This decision was erroneous for three reasons. First, it fails to account for the fact that charge one was a charge with divers occasions. It was not a charge with a single act. Secondly, the Army Court mischaracterizes the instruction that was given in this case. And thirdly, the decision mischaracterizes the decision of this court and what this court said about Villatoro in United States versus Hills. First, on the question of the divers occasions. In the recent decision, United States versus Guardado, this court examined the question of what is conveyed, what information is conveyed by a verdict. In that case, someone was found not guilty. And for that reason, there was an argument from the government side that we could all assume beyond a reasonable doubt that that meant that no one on the panel thought that the person was guilty, no way someone could find by preponderance and yet vote not guilty. And this, of course, is not true. There's a similar situation here. Because there's a divers occasion specification in charge one, that's the specification, divers occasions, and the testimony on that specification was that there were hundreds of incidents. And the finding of guilty on divers occasions means more than once. It is unknowable what the panel members would have said if the specification had said 50. It's unknowable what the panel members would have said if the specification had said 100. It is absolutely possible that a panel member could believe that there was more than one incident proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but that the number did not go that high. The testimony in this case was remarkable in the assertion, alleging that sometimes there were four or five assaults on the same day. And the panel is told to use their common sense and their knowledge of the ways of the world to evaluate testimony. So to use a very everyday common sense quotidian example, if someone says, I've told that kid 100 times today to close the door to the garage, the hearer might believe that that means that the kid was told more than once, but maybe not 100 times today. So to take the accusation seriously but not literally, that could have the result, then, of the person not believing that that number was accurate. The only thing that can be determined beyond a reasonable doubt by the panel verdict is that they thought it was more than once. That's divers occasions.
Counsel, could you do me a favor? I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm getting a little confused by the direction that your argument's going.
Oh, sorry.
I was under the impression that the lower court had held that this case was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because there was an exception to Hills because he gave the propensity instruction with respect to that they could use propensity with if they found that charge one had been proven by preponderance of the evidence, that they could use that to show propensity to do two, right? And so that they somehow said that that was an exception to Hills.
Yes, ma'am.
Assume for the sake of argument that I think that that was completely wrong, okay? Tell me why, even so, this wasn't harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Right? Based on the evidence. Like, why, based on the evidence in this case, wasn't the instruction, okay, harmless beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to charge two?
With respect to charge two,
if I'm getting the numbering right.
You are, Your Honor. One reason for the argument that I've made so far is because we are challenging the assertion of the Army Court that the propensity did not affect charge one in addition to charge two. And that goes to the nature of the accusation being divers occasions, and the instruction that was actually given in this case is mischaracterized by the Army Court in the Joint Appendix of 17. There is a characterization of, there's a paraphrase by the Army Court that asserts that it was simply one directional. But that is inaccurate. That paraphrase is inaccurate because it doesn't capture what was actually said. In the instructions at Joint Appendix 623, it's also more conveniently, I think, in the Joint Appendix at 4, because the first Army Court decision quotes that, and it has a separate sentence. And the mischaracterization takes this form. The Army Court asserts that there was limiting language. In the paraphrase, they have a prepositional phrase at the end saying, with regard to specification 2, implying by that adverbial prepositional phrase that the instruction was limited to, you can only consider this propensity evidence for charge 2. But in the original, at 632 in the Joint Appendix, there is a separate sentence. 623 has the has a separate sentence
what
which includes the word always.
What is the sentence?
It says that the
don't paraphrase.
Sorry, they have it exactly here. You may also consider the evidence of such other acts of sexual assault for its tendency, if any, to show the accused propensity or predisposition to engage in sexual assault.
Well, the instruction was the original, what we said, fallaciously confusing instruction, wasn't it, with the lessened burden of proof and everything else?
Yes, sir, absolutely.
Yeah, that wasn't changed because this was pre-Hills.
Yes, sir, exactly.
Yeah, so it was the pre-Hills instruction with the burdens of various burdens of proof floating about in the ether.
Precisely, Your Honor, okay. Exactly. And because of the divers occasions nature of the charge one, the taint affects charge one in addition to charge two. It was not actually, as they assert, unilateral. But secondly, in terms of whether it matters, if it somehow it's harmless if it's unilateral, that goes to my third point, actually, which is the mischaracterization of what this court said in Villatoro. So again, looking at what is actually in the opinion, Villatoro was addressed by this court in the section on the confusing nature of the instructions. As you say, Your Honor, the very confusing instruction with the different burdens of proof. But the heart of the Hills decision was expressly erosion of the presumption of innocence.
So you're, just to get back to your first point, so you're saying that when the judge instructed, you may also consider the evidence of such other acts of sexual assault or its tendency, if any, to show the accused propensity or predisposition to engage in sexual assault, you're saying that even though they were using charge one with respect to charge two, that somehow makes it broader?
It does, Your Honor.
I mean, is that a simpler way of saying whatever it is you've been trying to say?
It is, Your Honor. I'm trying to say that it would affect, that the panel could have applied propensity to charge one in addition to charge two.
Okay, well, let's say that we disagree with you. So go back to what I'm asking you, right, which is, why, based on the evidence, was this or was this not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because that's not actually what they're trying to use Villatoro to create or find an exception.
But yes. We're assuming that I agree with you, right, that they got all of that wrong. So I'm just trying to focus you on the evidence in this case.
Roger. Okay.
How was the evidence, based on the evidence in this case, right, why was the erroneous instruction with respect to using evidence of charge one as propensity to show that they committed charge two, why was it or was it not harmless beyond reasonable?
Your Honor, that is shown by effectively site-checking the places in the government brief that they point to and seeing through the puffery where the government argues that the evidence was strong. As in Huckel and as in Hills, this is a case where a witness testified that something happened, but there is not actually additional evidence.
What do you do about the fact that he gave a confession that tracks very closely to exactly what the victim said happened? And what do you do about the photo of the door?
Well, Your Honor, the photo of the door doesn't show anything of a sexual nature happened. So on closer examination, the evidence is not as strong as the government would have you believe.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
So are there any other points you want to make in that regard in terms of harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt? Your point about the door being smashed shows violence, perhaps an assault, but not necessarily a sexual assault.
Well, most, Your Honor.
Are there other points you'd like to make in terms of the harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
Yeah, regarding the evidence in the case, I'd like to return to that on rebuttal.
I'd like you to address it now.
The
harmlessness issue.
Your Honor, the government's argument and the Army Corps' argument that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt relied on the assertion that we somehow know that the panel voted first on charge one versus charge two, which of course we don't know.
But I'm focusing on the strength of the evidence, of the government's evidence, the evidence that was introduced. I'm not talking about the strength of the government's legal argument on appeal. I'm talking about the strength of the evidence that was introduced in the course of the trial at the court martial.
Your Honor, other than the citations in the government's brief that appear to be independent evidence are actually repetition of what the accusing witnesses told other people, and so that's not actually independent evidence.
Can I ask you another question, counsel? Let's assume that we find that the answer to the actual question, which is, did they erroneously find that the propensity instruction given falls with an exception, right? And we say, yes, they were erroneous, okay? Do you believe that their Article 66 review in light of that error would be complete?
No, Your Honor. At a minimum, it should be remanded for review in light of a correct reading of this court's decision in United States versus Hills and United States versus Guardado. And I mentioned Guardado again in particular with regard to the Army Court's overreading of the verdict and trying to infer, or to more accurately, just to speculate. When the government has a burden of showing something beyond a reasonable doubt, it doesn't suffice to point out what a verdict might mean. It should be limited to what the verdict actually does mean. And that applies as well to charge one, where the Army Corps is inferring that the panel members must have believed all of the accusations in their entirety, when the truth is that is unknowable, and it's possible that the members of the panel did not believe all of the accusations beyond a reasonable doubt. If members of the panel believed that some of them may have been, that the number of accusations that were valid differed between which ones they believed beyond a reasonable doubt and which ones they believed merely to a preponderance, then the propensity would affect charge one as well as charge two.
That's just the temporal point, right?
I'm sorry, sir?
That's just the temporality point.
Right. It's not only, it is the temporal error
that we cannot know in which order they considered or voted on or anything else. The two charges.
Your Honor, not only do we not know the order, that much is clear, but we also don't know, since the verdict finding was only divers occasions, which means more than once, we don't know, and the accusation was that there were hundreds of offenses. If the panel had been asked, if there had been special interrogatories, and do you believe that there were 50? Do you believe there were 100? At some point, a panel member might say no. One panel member might say no. I would not say beyond a reasonable doubt that there were more than 50. Another member might say no. I don't believe beyond a reasonable doubt that there were more than 100. That means there are some accusations that might have been believed merely to a preponderance, and then that propensity could have applied to charge one. So the Army Court decision does not account for the fact that this was a divers occasion. So even the assertion that it was unilateral is a mischaracterization of the instruction that was given and is overreading or reading into the verdict what is not actually proven by the verdict.
So it's your point that the instruction could have been read to also, even though it didn't refer to charge one, that it could have possibly been read to, since it was a sexual assault, a offense, charge one, that they might have read it that way?
Yes, Your Honor. Precisely. Subject to your questions, the appellant requests that the case be remanded to the Army Court for consideration in light of this court's opinions in United States v. Hills, United States v. Guardado.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Suki, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Allison Riley, and I, along with Captain Austin Fenwick, represent the United States in this case. Although the military judge gave an erroneous MRE 413 propensity evidence instruction in this case, the court should affirm the findings and sentence because charge one was not affected by this error, and the error pertaining to charge two was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Why was it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because, according to the instruction, the panel was only to consider charge one as propensity to prove charge two. And it only logically follows that they would have discussed and considered charge one first before coming to the conclusion as to charge two.
Counsel, I mean, what the CCA found and what you're arguing is just not supported by any reasonable reading of the instruction that was given, right? All it said was that they had to find that the charge one had been found by a preponderance of the evidence. And so how from there the CCA found that charge one had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt is perplexing to me.
Yes,
I mean,
sir.
Ultimately, they obviously found it was found beyond a reasonable doubt, but we have no idea what order they discussed things in.
Your Honor.
We don't, right? And to the extent that they rely on Villatoro, like in Villatoro, they were given a very different instruction, right? The instruction then was, to the effect in this case, if you find that charge one, that the evidence shows that charge one was found, was proven beyond a reasonable doubt, then you may use it to show propensity to have committed charge two, right? And so it's not that exception, and it's not the exception of they were found guilty in another trial, and it's not the exception of they pleaded guilty to the offense in this trial. So it is not a Hills exception. Okay, so explain then why, based on the evidence, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or explain why, given the fact that the CCA didn't consider any of these things, we should accept their Article 66 review.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, if this court finds that the Army erred, then it should be remanded back to ACCA in light of the court's decision. However, the error pertaining to charge two was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in light of the evidence the government presented in the case. There was no tangible risk as to
but
charge
how,
two.
When the CCA didn't look at any of that, do we know that they found would have otherwise found it was legally and factually sufficient? Because they relied on the propensity being okay.
Yes,
the use of the propensity evidence being fine.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
So if we disagree, if we disagree that that was okay, how can we be satisfied that their Article 66 review would have turned out the same way?
Your Honor,
other than that it's a sex offense case.
The case would have to be remanded back to ACCA for Article 60, for further Article 66 review.
Well, how many times do you have to kick this thing back? We did it once. We kicked this thing back for redo in light of Hills. Here it is again. You seem to agree with the appellate. They want us to do it too, but we already did that. So what are we supposed to do with this thing? Just let it bounce forever like one of those super balls?
I mean, and if I seem testy, it's because for the exact same reason that Judge Stuckey is saying. It's like Hill says what it says, and I understand that for whatever reason the CCAs are fighting it tooth and nail, but then fine, seek cert, get the Supreme Court to say that we're wrong. Right? That's what you do. You don't purport to carve out exceptions to the case that we've written that are on their face, like, patently absurd.
Yes, Your Honor, certainly the government.
And it's not fair to the accused, and it's a waste of government resources and our time as well.
Certainly, if the court, the government understands this court's position, that if the Army Court erred,
I mean, do you disagree? do disagree that this is not Villatoro, that the instruction in this case was not the instruction in Villatoro?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor. The instruction.
Do you agree that this case did not involve a charge where someone had been found guilty in another proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you agree that he didn't plead guilty to the charge?
Yes, Your Honor.
So under what universe was this an exception to Hills?
Well, when you look at the Army Court's opinion, they're finding that this was an exception. I do not know why they use the word exception, but the fact that one of their last sentences that there was that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt indicates that the Army Court's position was not that this was an error under Hills, but that there was error. It was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because presuming that the panel considered charge one first and found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and charge one was free of the taint of the propensity evidence because the instruction only flowed one way, that made it analogous to Villatoro, because the same concerns that this court had in Hills regarding the erosion of presumption of innocence and the lowering of the burden of proof was not present if the panel had in fact did that.
But we don't know that.
And this whole temporal thing, I mean, that you're arguing, and that I guess you're trying to like impute to the CCA, it's like, where is the evidence of that? We weren't in the members' deliberation room.
Your Honor, yes. And even if the panel did find charge one occurred by propensity evidence first and use it in such manner before, and then discussing charge two before going back to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of charge one, charge one was still unaffected by this instruction. And
so that's charge one. Okay, fine. But what about charge two?
Charge two, under a prejudice analysis, Your Honor, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of the nature of the evidence.
How do we know that the CCA considered that without also considering the propensity evidence? How do we know that the members didn't consider it?
Your Honor, can you repeat your question?
How do we know that the members didn't improperly consider charge one by preponderance of the evidence to convict on charge two? And how do we know that the CCA didn't do the same thing?
Well, Your Honor, even if the panel considered charge one by preponderance of the evidence to prove charge two, that error in the scheme of the government's case, the amount of evidence would have been enough to sway the members as to appellant's guilt as to charge two.
Now, yeah, but what you said, well, two is different because of the nature of the evidence. What do you mean by that? Do you mean that you had a picture of a busted door and you had other things like that? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
When you look at the facts of the case and the testimony and the evidence that was presented, there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt presented.
Well, there was some evidence. Let's not charge off into proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Obviously, the government thinks it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But what you're saying is there was something more than drawing an inference of predisposition to do this.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay, yeah, because you had a picture of a broken door and you had, you know, some other things.
Certainly, Your Honor. For instance, there is the appellant's confession, which closely matches the SW's version.
Okay, that's my question. Thank you. Go ahead.
So what do you make of the defense argument that we don't have to only be worried about the interplay between charge one and charge two? We have to be worried about the internal effects within charge one, that essentially the panel could have found with a diverse language that they first voted on the question of whether there was or discussed a preponderance of the evidence for charge one, and then essentially bootstrapped multiple incidents where they didn't find proof beyond a reasonable doubt to, in certain instances, a subset of diverse occasions, that there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt. How do you address that?
Within charge one, Your Honor?
Within charge one.
Your Honor, as you can see on Joint Appendix page 628, the judge was very clear in his instruction that he was discussing charge one as it relates to charge two.
And the loose language about the sexual assault, right, has nothing to do with rape, which is what charge two was.
Charge two was sodomy of SW, Your Honor, charge one was rape. Now, appellate argues that there's one line in the instruction that refers to other sexual assault. The word other would indicate something other than the charged offense. In fact, the very following instruction that the military judge gave was an instruction that the panel could consider an uncharged rape or attempted rape of T.W. to prove charge one. And so it's clear from the very wording of those two instructions put together that there was never an instruction that the charged specifications within charge one could be used to prove the other charged specifications in charge one.
Counsel, in the Hills decision, there was another exception in about either the last paragraph or next to the last paragraph when the court found that it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the only evidence was the testimony of the accused and there was no physical evidence to support that, no corroborating evidence. So I guess, would you call that an exception? If there's only the testimony of the victim and no physical evidence, would that be an exception? If, on the other hand, we had his confession, had fresh complaint to neighbors, broken down door, and so on, would that then overcome would that rise to the level it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in this case?
Yes,
and wouldn't have to look at any, quote, exception to Hills.
Yes, Your Honor, when we're looking at, quote, what this exception to Hills is, we're looking at whether, in fact, the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And we look at things like that, what the other corroborating evidence was. And when we look at the other corroborating evidence in this case, we see that there is more here than there was in Guardado.
If we do that, we don't have to speculate about how they voted and did all that kind of stuff. You know, there was a ton of evidence to convict the guy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
The problem that you have, counsel, is you'd like to characterize the CCA as saying that it was an exception to Hills, except insofar as it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But they said that the only propensity evidence the panel was allowed to consider stemmed from a specification that they had found independently proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Right? That's what they thought was the exception to Hills, and they cited Villatoro.
Yes, Your Honor, they did in fact do that, but their very last sentence of I believe it's the very last sentence. It could be the very second
last. They did say they found beyond a reasonable doubt under the circumstances of this case, but the only circumstances they've discussed about this case are the ones that I've been complaining about.
Yes, Your Honor, and even if this court were to read
it. It was my New Year's resolution to never complain again, but it's not working so far.
Yes, Your Honor. And so even if this court were to find that the Army erred in finding that this was an exception, remand to ACCA to reevaluate would be warranted.
Well, back to the Chief Judge's question, why bounce it back again? Why can't this court just say, we find it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or we find it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, end of the case?
Well, certainly this court has the power to determine the prejudice aspect and evaluate, was this harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And so, yes, this court could do that. But in light of the facts and circumstances of this case, the court should affirm the findings and sentence, and pending any questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal? In that case, the case is submitted, and the court is in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.